Texas A&M College of Medicine has a statewide campus, so I've been a professor of medicine at Texas A&M for about the last 10 years. I'm on the Baylor Dallas campus now. I'm in a private practice, and I maintain my board certifications in internal medicine and cardiology, but I also lead a research team in downtown Dallas. And when COVID-19 hit, I really redirected all of my focuses towards the pandemic. I recognized that this was going to be a giant challenge for us. We have actually very few infectious disease doctors in the United States. Hmm. They were completely subscribed in the hospital. I am much more of an outpatient-oriented doctor. And so I really poured all my efforts into scholarship in the last year on COVID-19. In a sense, I've done a self-directed fellowship in infectious disease. I've published the first treatment guidance on how to treat COVID-19 as an outpatient. These are the most widely utilized publications in all of COVID-19 in the world for outpatient treatment. I've been relied upon by the U.S. Senate to testify in the Senate, the Texas Senate, and to render my opinion. I've been blessed to be a regular contributor on Fox News almost every week now over the last several months in the pandemic. So I'm glad to be here, try to help out the business owners best I can. People have asked me, what type of authority do I have to give any opinions in COVID-19? I've said, listen, in my field before COVID came, I was the most published person in my field in the world in history. It has to do, my field is the interface between heart and kidney disease. How do these two organs communicate with one another? I'm the editor-in-chief of Cardiorenal Medicine, the editor-in-chief of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine. I have 600 peer-reviewed publications in the National Library of Medicine. I've lectured all over the world, the New York Academy of Sciences, National Institutes of Health, FDA. I'm kind of on the calling card of someone who has a position of authority in medicine. Since COVID-19, I have over 45 publications in COVID-19. I've published the first two sets of treatment guidance where no one else would step up. I've had the illness myself. I've had serious cases in my family, including fatalities. I think as a single person, I probably have the most authority to give my opinion on what's going on in this pandemic than anyone in the world. And I can tell you, the problem with what Americans are seeing on TV right now is they are not seeing doctors like me working in teams of doctors and advising the country. We're down to one or two people that government officials that Americans see on TV, who, by the way, are not board certified. They don't have qualifications in doing what they're doing right now. And as singular people, they are issuing not recommendations, not guidance, they're issuing directives. And we're seeing these things come down over time, so we can tackle them one by one.
That's very, very interesting. So how do you, you've seen some successes last year?
Oh, absolutely. First off, we should probably just tackle five really important points. When this first hit, no one knew what this virus was about, including myself. But we do have a year and 3 months later, we have a framework of understanding. The first important point, the virus spreads from sick person to a well person, period. The virus does not spread from asymptomatic person to asymptomatic. It took months to get these data, paper by Cao out of China, one by Madewell, published in the best journals. It does not spread asymptomatically. If anybody in this room has the virus right now, but they have no symptoms, they can't spread it to us. In fact, they're forming their own immunity. It's asymptomatic spread must be less than 1% of all spread. Okay, because of that, that means that asymptomatic testing, routine testing that people have been subject to, was completely useless.
Right.
In the United States, we've had 35 million cases of COVID. We've actually burned 400 million COVID tests right now. Even the World Health Organization says, June 25th, now they're late, June 25th, they said, stop the asymptomatic testing. All this nasal and oral testing was never approved for routine screening. It was never approved for people to get on airplanes or anything else. That was just an overreach. So that's point number one is no asymptomatic spread. Point number two, asymptomatic testing is a complete waste of time. It's not FDA approved. It's not even advised by the World Health Organization. Okay. Third point, very important. Natural immunity. Once somebody's had the virus, is robust, complete, and durable. You can't get it twice. You know, when grandmother had it last year, she's not gonna get it again. We've seen it sweep through the nursing homes, it's done. It's a one and done. There is this narrative that people keep getting COVID and over again. But yet when you ask people, no, I've had it and I'm done, it's one and done. There's even been challenges where Cleveland Clinic published a study where people had recovered. They went right back and worked with COVID right in their face. You can't get it again. So this idea of it's one and done, natural immunity is robust, complete, and durable. Very important. So if you have workers in your business that have had COVID, they don't have to worry. They're not going to get it again. There's this incredible continuing fear. There are legal demands into the CDC to recognize natural immunity. Even Governor Abbott here in Texas, by executive order in April, has an executive order, natural immunity. We recognize it in Texas by executive order.
Isn't that crazy that that's a legal
thing? We have to write an executive. So yeah. Natural immunity, and again, people say, do I have to take the vaccine? Well, of course you don't. You can't get it a second time. Okay, so that's the third point. The fourth point is the virus is treatable. That was our work. So we know now that we have an approach. People over 50 who have additional medical problems have a greater than 1% chance of being hospitalized or dying. That's enough to treat. And we have treatment protocols that involve some FDA-approved emergency use authorized antibodies. I can make a phone call. Patients can go right down here to Baylor and get an antibody infusion free of charge. It's wonderful.
Oh, wow.
America government, we've bought 500 million doses of these monoclonal antibodies, but there's no word of them. You don't see them on TV. There's no way to 1-800 numbers. When people get their COVID test result, they're not told how to access these. Your businesses and your listeners and your viewers should know, demand an antibody infusion. Call your hospital and say, listen, you know, my grandmother's sick with COVID-19. I want an antibody infusion. Now's the time to get activated because your government agencies are not helping you on early treatment. We're busting the myth that COVID is not treatable. I'm here to tell you it is treatable. The key publications, I'm the first author, American Journal of Medicine in 2020, Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine in 2020. These are the most cited and utilized and relied upon papers in all of COVID-19 in the world, okay, for early treatment. Patients over age 50 with multiple medical problems, that's the only group that really needs treatment. Now, a younger person who presents with severe symptoms or a younger person with some problem like cystic fibrosis, sure, they could require treatment. But in general, it's 25% of adults. Seniors ought to demand these monoclonal antibody infusions. President Trump got it. After that, the drugs that work are used in combination and in sequence, and they're based on a signal of benefit and acceptable safety. It's so early in the disease process, we don't have proven efficacy and safety. We don't. It's a signal of benefit, acceptable safety. So what can be used? Hydroxychloroquine, supported by 200 studies. Hydroxychloroquine, countries like us appropriately stockpiled it for a reason. Hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, 60 supportive studies. We combine it with doxycycline or azithromycin. Everybody can use an inhaler, budesonide inhaler. Richard Bartlett was the first to discover this in Texas, proven in the UK in the STOIC trial. We can use, on day 5 or pulmonary symptoms, oral prednisone, much like how an asthmatic would use or someone with an allergic condition. We use a gout medication for 30 days in higher risk patients called colchicine, one pill a day, proven in a large randomized trial from Montreal Heart Institute called Cold Corona Trial, 4,000 patients. We use aspirin, 325 milligrams a day, because this virus is unique. It causes blood clotting. It's the only viral infection we've ever seen that causes blood clotting, and that's what actually kills patients, is blood clotting. So we use aspirin as a blood thinner, but it's a full adult dose. Higher risk patients, we actually use Lovenox injections, just like someone would get for the treatment of a blood clot. That's what's called sequence multi-drug therapy. It's all done at home. It's supported by the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, aapsonline.org. Download the home treatment guide. Be ready. It's also supported by another group in the United States called the Frontline Critical Care Consortium. They have a little different sets of protocols, but the principles are the same. Now, these are well in advance of the CDC, the NIH, or the FDA, or the Infectious Disease Society of America, that have yet to publish any outpatient treatment guidelines.
What do you think that's all about?
They've been focusing on, appropriately so, inpatients. So one of the reasons I wanted to fill this void is, how many years are we going to wait and have Americans suffer before they get any treatment at home? We can even order oxygen concentrators at home with a simple phone call, because under the emergency use authorization, we can actually get them out to the home and get people supplemental oxygen. We've been so successful at this, that has an 85% reduction in the risk for hospitalization and death. I've treated patients well into their 90s And we've avoided the panic and the fear and the isolation of the hospital. The contemporary mortality rate in the hospital right now, if someone needs the ICU in the United States, 38%. And that's published by the Stop COVID Collaboration out of Harvard. So the point number four is it's treatable. It takes about 4 to 6 drugs. Adults who with mild cases, about 5 days. Average person our age, about 10 days. Seniors, it could be about 30 days. It's a longer illness. Now, what about people under 50? People under 50, they breeze through COVID. A nutraceutical bundle, which is recommended for everybody, is reasonable, includes zinc, vitamin C, vitamin D, and quercetin, helps kind of fortify the nutrition alpha. A younger person develops severe symptoms, they can move into treatment. But we're talking about only 25% of people get COVID need early treatment. It helps them avoid the hospital or death, and younger people breeze through this. So that's point number four. Point number five has to do with this contentious issue of the vaccine. And I've rendered my opinion on this multiple times. The vaccines are brand new. They are, in the United States, we have Pfizer, Moderna, J&J. They are a brand new technology. They are nothing like a flu shot. Nothing like a flu shot.
That's right.
They actually transfer genetic material inside our cells, and they cause our cells to make part of the original virus, the spike protein on the virus. So there's the ball, the nucleocapsid, and the little spines, the spikes. The vaccines kind of trick our body into making the spike protein, and then we form an immune reaction to it. The short discussion on the vaccines is that while half of Americans have taken them, for some individuals, the vaccines have not worked out too well in terms of being sufficiently safe for human use. Now, obviously, you know, many tens of millions of Americans took it. They had a sore arm. They got through it just fine. People in my family took it. It's not a big deal if there's no complications. But for those who are getting complications, and we're currently at, as of today, the CDC has told us, we're at 12,000 Americans that have died after the vaccine. 86% of the time, independent reviewers have determined the vaccine caused the death, and that 50% of the deaths occur within 48 hours, 80% of the deaths occur within a week, and it's a modern-day tragedy. We've never had any medical product ever in the history of mankind result in 12,000 American deaths. We have 400,000 certified vaccine injuries right now due to the vaccine along the lines of neurologic, cardiac, immunologic, or hematologic abnormality. So that's about a size of a medium-sized city right now of people who have vaccine injuries. So there's great concern as we move forward that the vaccines look like they don't have a safety profile to be the solution to the problem.
I'm hearing that it's more in this short period of time than over the last 15 years of VAERS data.
Right. So what we know is that the number of deaths has exceeded the cumulative total, even reported into the data system, for all time. Just to give you an idea, we have 70 vaccines on the market, about 500 million shots, roughly. I had two this year. I had shingles and flu. You know, everyone gets vaccines. That 500 million shots, 70 vaccines, the average number of deaths that would be reported into the database was about 150 or so. On January 22nd, we are already at 186 with the COVID-19 deaths. And as I told you, as we sit here today, we've already raced up to 12,000 deaths. It's an astronomical number. Almost everybody knows somebody who either died or has been injured with the vaccines now. People are talking, and Americans are worried that our federal officials have not come clean on safety. We have not had a press briefing on overall vaccine safety. Can you imagine that? We should have probably weekly briefings, or at least monthly briefings, because we want to make sure the program is safer. There may be certain people who shouldn't get the vaccine. For instance, COVID recovered. You can't get COVID a second time. If they took the vaccine and they've already been revved up from their first infection, are they the people who are getting the complications? We don't know because our agencies have not fairly disclosed things. Is it among diabetics? Is it among patients with prior neurologic or cardiac disease? No one knows because our agencies, and this is a terrible word to say on the air, but the correct word is malfeasance. It's wrongdoing by those in position of authority. And so that's what we're having right now. Just like the trusted news service is pre-stated censorship, we now have malfeasance by our government agents on safety. The second update on the vaccines is that while half of Americans take them and have taken them, and we wish every single person well, we have deeply concerning reports now out of the United Kingdom and out of Israel that the vaccines are failing. And what I mean by that is the virus has mutated, and the current version is called Delta. That's our most recent version in the United States. It's now the predominant version. And the mutations are occurring because we're vaccinating. And there is a paper from the Mayo Clinic in Boston by Neeson and colleagues that have shown when we get to 25% of the population vaccinated, the virus starts to mutate. It's actually going to try to escape the effect of the vaccine. So now the Delta variant has escaped the effect of, for sure, the Pfizer vaccine, because we know in Israel now, 80% of people have had COVID in Israel right now have been fully vaccinated with Pfizer.
So, Dr. Bercola, I've had COVID about 4 months ago, and from everything that I'm hearing, I probably should wait and see what happens with regard to the shots and where they're going to lead, because it doesn't sound like, A, number one, I'm not going to get it again, and number two, we're in this sort of no man's land.
Well, as I've mentioned, when the case is well defined, you've had it, you had the characteristics, signs and symptoms, you had a positive PCR or antigen test, and the case is well defined, there has actually never been reported so far in the world a second case. Now, the difficulty is when the first case is not well defined, you didn't get a test or you're not really sure, there's a lot of uncertainty. And an analysis by Merchu and colleagues has taken analyses of 11 studies, 615,000 individuals, even with an ill-defined case in a population, and looked at a year later what happened. The risks of COVID, even in not so clear cases like yours, the risk of COVID was 0.2%. So what I'm telling you, it's infinitesimally low. It's so low that, in my view, one doesn't need to be worried about COVID-19. I've had it myself. I don't go through my day in fear. I could encounter a patient with COVID-19, and I know I can't get the virus. I know the vaccine can't benefit me. In fact, the FDA, CDC, Moderna, and J&J excluded people like you and me from the clinical trials. They knew we couldn't get COVID-19.
I thought we were the clinical trial.
No, the registrational clinical trials had exclusion criteria. There's very important. COVID recovered, suspected COVID recovered, pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, even people with positive antibodies. They were excluded because the FDA knew we couldn't benefit and we would only be harmed by the vaccine. In fact, they were right. COVID recovered patients in three studies, Methodius, Raw, and Kammer, have shown us that COVID recovered patients, when they take the vaccine, which they don't need, they actually have higher side effects, including ended up with something serious in the hospital. So I've told America a prior COVID infection is a contraindication to getting the vaccine. You should not get the vaccine. And it's sad to say that right now in America, in the world, about 25 to 30% of people taking the vaccine have already had COVID. So the vaccine can't help them at all. It can only hurt them.
And we had another question.
For the small businesses and schools, my daughter's she's going to elementary, or no, middle school, the mask wearing and the argument against that being effective. So for us, we don't believe that the mask shields the virus. So, and then with CDC requiring that we wear masks, or some businesses or schools, they used to, and I'm fearful that they'll do it again, and they're not effective. So what are there any suggestions, or do you see any light at the end of the tunnel with building an argument against that for those who go to legal counsel to try to argue their rights? I'm trying to figure out how else to ask that more clearly, but what rights do we have?
Okay, so let's just go through masks. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our public health response for months was absolutely focused, unnecessarily so, on masking. And I think if we would have taken the focus off masks and actually focused on treatment, treating sick people, we would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And I think masks and having masks morning, noon, and night on TV commentary are federal officials, which they probably had innumerable press briefings on the mask. Can you imagine? We haven't had a single press briefing on vaccine safety, and we're asking people to take these vaccines, but yet we've had a million press briefings on the mask. Well, here's a couple points. The virus is about 1 micron in size. The mask filters out 3 microns, even the really good ones. So the virus moves in and out of the mask very easily. That's number one. There have been 12 randomized trials. That's our gold standard, including most recently the Dan mask trial, showing public masking has no benefit. In Dallas, we've had a natural experiment. We had our Dallas Independent School District shut down. Parochial schools didn't. We never had any school outbreaks. There's never been any school outbreaks across the United States. There's never been a credible case of a student giving the virus to a teacher. It's never happened. Pulling the kids out of school and making the kids wear masks retrospectively was a complete and total waste of time. Those of you who have college students, and I'm kind of in that age range too, I had a college student in my office the other day, and he was being seen for a cardiac problem. And I asked him, I said, how was college like at University of Texas? He goes, well, it's kind of boring in the day. We didn't have classes. We were on WebEx. I said, what happened after that? Oh, we played basketball. We went out. We went to the bars and we socialized and we dated. It was like, well, then what's the purpose? I mean, the whole idea of school and having the kids out of school was completely counterproductive. So what you need to know about masks, I'm a doctor. I'm a cardiologist and internist. Do I wear a mask at a hospital? Sure, I do. Do I wear a mask in the cath lab or go in the operating room? Sure. How about dentists? How about barbers? People working at close contact? Not because of COVID so much, but if you have a big cough or sneeze, the last thing you want to do is sneeze on somebody. So I think masks are here to stay for people who work at close contact. We did see a reduction in influenza last year, and it's almost out of common courtesy. So I don't mind it so much in the medical environment. But public masking under no circumstances at this point in time should move forward. Parents should know their rights. There are child psychologists, not my area, but are telling me they're worried that the kids are not going to develop correctly because they can't read each other's faces. They can't understand perceptive human emotion.
That's our suspicion.
There are data suggest that actually the bacterial and fungal pathogens that are nasopharyngeal tract are actually trapped in the masks, that it's not good hygiene. And we've seen things carried to the extreme. You know, people running track races, wearing a mask and keeling over. People swimming with masks on. People wearing masks, driving alone in the car. The masks have basically become to symbolize our fear. And I think we just need to put it down.
Do we have any other questions?
Yeah, so you talk a lot about malfeasance, and we keep hearing the word misinformation, and certain bodies that we didn't elect are labeling certain things that people like you are saying as misinformation, and now it's coming out that that was wrong. There's been a lot of harmful effects from this malfeasance and mislabeling and censoring of quote-unquote misinformation. I think a lot of people want to know what can be done about this, and I think a lot of people are questioning if there's an agenda behind this, and maybe not, but at the end of the day, there's been some harm and malfeasance, as you say. So what can be done about this to the people who carried on the misinformation labeling and the malfeasance?
It's one of the reasons why I'm sitting right in front of you. Is that I've been so careful to cite the literature. I may be the first person who told you about the Trusted News Initiative. This was actually out there. You can go type it in on your browser, on your phone. It'll read Trusted News Service. It's basically an overt censorship program. The medical director of YouTube has said publicly, we're not gonna fairly post things. We are going to filter things out. We're going to squash anything on early treatment, and we're going to squash anything on vaccine safety in order to promote the vaccine. That's what this is all about. It's very overt. People shouldn't be upset about this. They're the ones creating the rules. What's not fair to Americans, though, is if our Center for Disease Control has got 400,000 safety reports, 12,000 Americans who have died after the vaccine, and they're stonewalling us on safety with no press release, press briefing, that's what I call malfeasance. And there's no secret where the current head of our National Allergy and Immunology Division is being fried in front of the U.S. Senate with interrogation about his role in all of this. Americans have not seen teams of qualified doctors working in teams, coming up with fair decisions. They're not seeing competent, board-certified doctors who are experienced in treating COVID. When I testified in the U.S. Senate, I was on the majority presentation. I was the lead witness in the November 19th U.S. Senate, has really now historic Senate hearings. The minority witness went on for 2 hours trying to rebut me. And finally, Senator Johnson asked him a question. He said, "Doctor, have you ever treated a COVID patient?" And then you could hear a pin drop. He goes, "No, I've never treated a COVID patient." Now, what is this media doctor who's testifying in the U.S. Senate? He's never even seen a COVID patient, let alone treat a COVID patient, opining. So I think Americans need to draw a hard line with what they're listening to. And you know what? That's the reason why they're seeking out people like me. I'm just trying to give you fair information. I don't want to have to do this. But right now, our agencies are not helping us. And the media, the major media, is absolutely blindsiding patients and individuals. In fact, giving wrong information, and business owners are now stuck. So business owners should have learned a lot of things. We don't have to do asymptomatic testing. With people, schools, what do we have to do for schools? If the kids are sick, keep them at home. Don't send a sick kid to school. Do you know, I'm at Baylor. I go into work every day in the hospital. Do you know I've never had a test done for work ever? Do you know that when I got COVID-19 myself, I called human resources. I said, "What do I need to do? Do I need to get a test before I go back?" She goes, "Are you kidding?" She goes, "These tests stay positive for 90 days afterwards because they are cranking up the sensitivity of the test." She goes, "No, just if your fever's gone, as long as your cough is manageable, we'll come back to work." I said, "Wow." When I testified in the Texas Senate, March 10th of this year, I had to go through this complicated army tent, and I had to go through this asymptomatic testing in an army tent before I went in the Texas Senate building. And when I got on the floor, I testified to the Department of Health and Human Services. I said, "This is a Senate building. Everybody here is well. Why am I being tested and I'm not tested at the hospital where I wouldn't come in contact with sick people?" You can see decisions are not being made even based on common sense. Everyone would know a hospital is a higher risk environment than the Texas Senate building.